This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As schools across the country struggle to adapt curriculum to meet the new National Common Core standards, one controversial aspect of education is not included: sex education. Depending on your age, you may have been introduced to the mysteries of sex through nature-inspired metaphors that do little to enlighten students on the reality or outcomes of sexual activity. Or the focus may have been a purely biological discussion about human sex organs. The question of how or even whether to instruct students about sex has been a contentious subject in the U.S. since the 20th century. And as our next guest discovered, the debate rages on worldwide. Jonathan Zimmerman is professor of education and history at New York University and author of a new book that investigates sex education called Too Hot to Handle: A Global History of Sex Education. And Professor Zimmerman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So when and why did schools start teaching kids about sex?
Well, schools started teaching kids about sex first in the United States, which is important, in the early 20th century amidst big venereal disease outbreaks in places like New York and Chicago. Put plainly, middle-class men were patronizing prostitutes, which has always been a major conduit of STDs, and going home and infecting their wives. And this created great panic across our cities and a demand to teach kids in schools, adolescents, sexual continence. To be clear, there were VD outbreaks in places like Paris and Berlin as well during the same years. But what's interesting is that in those cities and societies, the solutions at that time tended to be more legal ones, having to do with the regulation and restriction of prostitution. But Americans, to address this shared problem, seized distinctively on an educational solution.
And what was the educational solution like? What was contained in the instruction?
Well, at the time, it relied heavily on plant and animal metaphors. Teach kids about the pollination of flowers and how rabbits reproduce. And the reason for that was actually quite simple. We wanted to teach kids about sex and especially the dangers of human sexuality outside of marriage without increasing their interest in it. You know, so much of school, especially modern so-called progressive education, is built around the idea of engaging kids' interests and engaging them in activity. What's different and ironic about sex ed, of course, is you're trying to quell their interest and prevent activity.
Right. This is often the argument, right, against sex education, that it promotes promiscuity. You're introducing kids to sex too early.
Right. And so as a way to try to ward off that claim and to teach without sparking interest, in the early 20th century, we use metaphors from the animal and plant world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've continued to hear that argument about sex education. Are those same arguments against sex education those that are fought globally?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, they have been really since the 1950s and 1960s, with a big, big spike in the 1980s and 90s because of the HIV epidemic. AIDS changed everything in this world, and unsurprisingly, it changed sex ed, because before AIDS, some people were for sex ed and other people were against it. The people who were against it made arguments like, it's a family matter, it's a matter of parental rights, the school shouldn't intervene in the family, and so on. What you see after HIV is that mostly that argument goes away. HIV created so much turmoil, so much panic, and so much suffering that everybody became for sex ed. They just became for different kinds of sex ed. So in the United States, something developed called abstinence-only education. it's important to note that something like absence-only education, while it may seem retrograde to some listeners, was in fact a huge step for conservatives in this country and in other places, because it acknowledged that the school had a role in teaching about sex, which prior to AIDS, many conservatives said it didn't.
Well, this is what's interesting watching in your book, this kind of swinging pendulum between sex education as a safety and survival issue and a moral issue, or something that's, say, purely biological to something more nuanced. Where are we now?
Well, you know, I would say that one of the takeaways from the book is the search for a, quote, purely biological sex ed is essentially a fool's errand. Because one of the things we know about sex is, to use a loaded adverb, it is intimately tied to human value and faith systems. I would say that even the claim that sex ed should be only about biology is itself a heavily value-laden statement. So sex ed takes many forms around the world, but I think it's fair to say that in most parts of the world, the value that's taught is keep this activity inside marriage and exclude it from non-marital situations. Mm-hmm. That, too, is a value statement, and I think that's the most common one that's taught via sex ed.
We're speaking with Jonathan Zimmerman. He's a professor of education and history at NYU. He's out with a new book called Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. And you do, in your book, make a big distinction between Western and non-Western or developing nations and approaches to sexuality. Often the narrative we have here in the U.S. is that we don't censor violence, but we censor sex, you know, whereas someplace like Sweden is the opposite. How do we stack up there?
Yes, well, you know, one of the other stories I tell in the book is that although the U.S. was early in the game, very much of a pioneer, the American model, which was one of control and controlling negative outcomes, did come under challenge after the Second World War from continental Europe, especially, as you mentioned, Sweden, which was the first country to require sex ed nationally. They're very proud of that. The founder of sex ed in Sweden is on postage stamps and sculptures, you know, all over the country. But the Swedish model was much more focused on the individual and helping an individual develop a healthy sexuality. And I find that contrast fascinating because I think it also contrasts with many other transatlantic comparisons we make, where we say the United States is all about the individual, but in these European social democracies, they're much more about the collectivity, about the whole. Mm-hmm. I would say in the sex ed realm, it's quite the opposite from that. And U.S. sex ed began and continues, I think, to emphasize that collective health. And in places like Sweden, it's much more oriented towards the individual.
Well, that's a very, you know, culturally influenced kind of approach. And I'm wondering about the teachers themselves, the educators. How are they trained to best present sex education to children?
Well, you know, one of the many, many myths that we have about Sweden is that everyone's on the same page there. They never have been. It turns out that in Sweden, after they instituted this new sex ed curriculum, that there was all kinds of resistance on the part of the teachers, and there continues to be. They didn't receive very good preparation for doing it. And also, they felt like it was an embarrassing subject and that teaching it would undermine their own authority as teachers. It's embarrassing for many reasons, but one of them is that it addresses the teacher's own sexuality, at least indirectly, right? The teacher's a sexual being. So when the teacher is enjoined to teach sex ed, at directly or indirectly, the teacher's sexuality is going to come into play. And so for female teachers, this proved to be a very difficult dilemma. Either you were an old maid who wasn't experienced enough, or you were kind of a young hussy who was too interested and too experienced. Wow. How do you walk that line as a female teacher? It's quite difficult.
Well, and Sweden is one place, but in the developing world, you point out that a number of teachers, you know, it was an education for them to learn about sex ed, especially in places where sexuality is so taboo.
Hugely so. And again, especially for women teachers, you know, who often told researchers that, you know, in my country, a woman who talks about sex is a prostitute. And so I can't be associated with that by talking about this subject. So I think there were and continue to be enormous taboos, and the subject puts a huge amount of pressure on teachers who often have very little cultural authority themselves, and who, especially in the developing world, have a myriad of other you know, near to impossible task, you know, teaching 50 or 60 kids of different ages in one room. The other, I think, really important historical factor to keep in mind that's cognate to this discussion is the post-war era is also the first era that schools themselves at the adolescent level become sexual spaces because girls go to school.
Right.
Right? Uh-huh. Of course, they did before, but not in such huge numbers. I think the really important story of the past 50 years is that schools, as formal institutions, became universal in the world. When I was born, you know, around 1960, only half of human beings stepped into a school during their lifetime, and now upwards of 95% do.
Well, there's clearly no international consensus on how sex education should be taught, even from school to school. But is there any kind of national standard for sex education in the United States?
There isn't. The United States has 14,000 school districts. You know, that's one of the things that makes it both so fascinating and so perilous to study American education like I do, you know. And ever since I wrote this book, I've gotten fascinating emails from people that tell me I've got the story all wrong because they experienced something different.
Mm-hmm.
And surely sex ed in Brookline, Massachusetts is going to look very different from sex ed in Lubbock, Texas. I mean, I say that without knowing what it looks like in either places, but I do know those communities are very different. But I would also say that it's fair to assume that even within those communities, there's going to be variation because Americans are so transient. You know, we're constantly moving. So to get back to your question, is there a national curriculum or a set of national messages taught about sex that there isn't in our country? The first reason is that education remains primarily a local affair, a locally governed, locally constituted affair. And the second reason is that we're so diverse even within those localities.
Mm-hmm. Any kind of successful models for teaching students about sex now that you found in your research and that could be backed up by some data?
Well, it's an interesting question because obviously it hinges on what you mean by success, right? And in the United States, the way that we've historically measured that has to do with, again, trying to control these negative outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So teenage pregnancies, that kind
right.
of thing.
Does it reduce teenage pregnancy? Does it reduce teenage STDs? And I think it's fair to say that the research based on that question is extremely small because sex ed is so haphazard and brief. If a kid in high school gets a total of 5 to 10 hours of sex ed throughout high school, showing that 5 or 10 hours actually affected the kid's sexual decision-making is a hugely difficult thing. We have some little glimmers that certain programs have had success, but I think it's fair to call them glimmers. And that's why in this debate, if you hear anybody on any side of the political spectrum make a blanket statement with huge certitude that sex ed does X behaviorally, either on the right, you know, it makes people have more sex, or on the left, it makes them behave in more sexually responsible ways, use contraception, et cetera. You can pretty much write them off as an ideologue because, you know, if something's happening that rarely, to claim that it's having such a strong and observable behavioral effect, it's not really a plausible claim. I would say that if you're defining success in these behavioral terms, it's really hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an important if because, you know, in a country like Sweden, one of the things I discovered was that wasn't the measure of success. The measure of success was, you know, are kids leading a healthy and pleasurable sexual life? And that goes way beyond the question of these negative outcomes. It's also quite difficult to determine, but it's a different goal.
Well, right. No clear answers for a complicated issue. And Jonathan Zimmerman, thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is a professor of education and history at NYU and author of a new book that looks at how sex education has changed over the years and what's going on with it globally. Too Hot to Handle is the title, A Global History of Sex Education. And you can find more in the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, Jonathan Zimmerman laid it out quite plainly. Sex ed varies wildly from country to country, state to state, and school to school. That's something the Word of Mouth crew discovered when we talked about sex education when we were growing up.
I don't remember a lot about sex ed in school, but I remember one specific moment, and I think I was in fifth grade, and it was in the wake of Ryan White, and it was when Ryan White had been... He'd been diagnosed with AIDS and they weren't allowing him to go to school. And there was a lot of fear behind that. And the lesson that I remember is that our teacher came in, she was a science teacher, and she put down a beaker of liquid. She told us that for us to get AIDS from saliva, we would have to drink that amount of liquid. And I just remember all of us being stunned into silence, like, oh my gosh, that's disgusting. Like, that's so much saliva.
So I remember very little except that our science teacher, Mr. Hartnett, he was also, I think, the hockey coach at Runlet Junior High, but this was at Conan School. But all I remember was being mixed in this classroom of boys and girls and uteruses on overhead projectors, and I was profoundly embarrassed that this conversation, which was really purely biological, was taking place in mixed company because I knew what it was about more than I knew what was being communicated.
So I don't remember like the official sex ed, but I lived in England for a year when I was a kid. I was like 10. And there was this period of time where we must have done some sort of like reproductive unit because they offered a bunch of books that were about like reproductive biology. And there was this one book, and it was about sex, and it was illustrated with these like really goofy sort of like balloon-like people, like their bodies were just like one big circle and they had like stick legs and arms. And there was these series of illustrations showing these people having sex in all these really weird settings. Like one of them, they were having sex on a skateboard and they're like holding balloons. And I remember just being so confused because how could you do something like that on a skateboard?
But when it comes to learning about sex in school, one member of the Word of Mouth crew really drew the short straw. Here's senior producer Maureen McMurray.
I went to Leominster High in Massachusetts, in Central Mass, and we had a health course. And as part of that health course, there was sex ed. And my sex ed teacher was also my cross-country coach. We'd already sort of gone through the curriculum, you know, where you see the diagrams and this and that, but it was that part of the course where you're supposed to have the discussion and kind of, you know, rap about sex issues, peer pressure, and things like this. I was in the ninth grade. I was sitting next to my friend Angela, and my teacher, you can bleep out his name if you want, Mr. comes into the classroom and then brings out a boom box, hands out papers, a questionnaire to everyone, and then hits play.
And it was?
Meatloaf, Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Well, I remember every little thing as if it happened only yesterday. And so instead of engaging the students in a conversation, he decided that he would let Meatloaf do the talking for him. And I never had a girl looking any better than you did. Keep in mind, this was 1993.
And then that must have been made in the mid-70s, the Meatloaf record, right?
I think it was 77, 2 years before any of the students in that class were born.
Oh, so it was his filter of sex ed, I guess,
so
not really focused on you.
No. But at that point, I'm in the ninth grade. We were listening to Dr. Dre. I think Rex and Effects Rump Shaker was at the top of the charts, like filthy, dirty songs. And he was thinking, Meatloaf is going to blow the, it's going to blow your mind. He's really cutting edge. We're going to go all the way tonight. We're going to go all the way tonight. We're going to go all the way tonight. And then there's that part. I'm seriously getting chills right now just thinking of it. I'm so embarrassed. Where there's are kind of like the sexy sounds. Oh. And it's a very long song, as I discovered, as we all had to sit there uncomfortably in Mr. Q's class listening to it. There's the wind-up, and there it is, a line shot up the middle. Look at him go, this boy can really fly. In the questionnaire, as you went through it, said, you know, what do you think the baseball signifies? What does paradise mean? What is... And I remember just giggling with my friend Angela, and we put sex down for every single one. We were like, sex, we think it means sex. Batter steps up to the plate. Here's the pitch, and he's going, and what a jump he's got. He's trying to serve. And then I think at the end of the song, it is a home run. The baseball player makes it to home. So what kind of message is that? Holy cow, I think he's going to make it. Stop right there.
So, Maureen, what do you think you learned that day?
I learned that baseball can sometimes mean sex. That's about it. So that was that's how I learned about the birds and the bees.
And that's Word of Mouth senior producer Maureen McMurray reminiscing about her school's musical approach to sex education. And we'll stay with the awkward adolescent years for just a bit longer. Up next, forget time off for new parents, the case for taking family leave when those kids become teenagers. That's after the break. Baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it. I'll give you an answer in the morning.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his State of the Union address earlier this year, President Obama promised to make paid leave for new parents a priority.
So it's time we stop treating childcare as a side issue or as a women's issue and treat it like the national economic priority that it is for all of us.
While parental leave has been shown to benefit in the early development and health of newborns, Jennifer Senior argues the policy should not stop after the first 12 weeks. Jennifer is contributing editor for New York Magazine, where we found her article, The Case for Taking Parental Leave When Kids Are Teenagers. She's also author of the book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, which is just out in paperback. And Jennifer, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So is that tongue-in-cheek, you know, taking parental leave for teenagers? Why are the teenage years so important?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked if it was tongue-in-cheek, because of course it is, in the sense that right now we don't even have a paid maternity or paternity leave policy for, you know, newborns. So I don't expect this to happen anytime soon. And I don't by any means want to trivialize the importance of the early years, right? It's just that there's a lot of very interesting and compelling data about the complications of the teen years, that's all. And what I was keying off of was this one extremely interesting study that looks at whether there's any correlation between how much time parents spend with their children and outcomes. And I mean outcomes along a variety of axes, you know, whether it's academic performance or behavior or emotional well-being. And the striking conclusion of the study was that there really is almost no difference. It doesn't matter how much time you spend with your kid, right? The outcomes are not correlated to time. They're much better correlated to sort of socioeconomic level and education levels, except for this one thing. Adolescence, the more time you spend with adolescents, engage time, if you're a mother, that seems to reduce delinquency. And both parents, if you spend more time with your kids, that tends to improve outcomes across a broad array of areas, including academic performance, some behavioral stuff, some emotional stuff. So it seems to have an effect.
So parents are, you know, if we're talking about adolescents, there are specific things that are potentially at risk for adolescents. What are some of the things that active parenting can help with?
Well, here's the thing, right? One of the bigger findings, and it was not a huge statistical difference, but it was enough for the authors to see, is delinquency, right? So substance abuse, right? Smoking, drinking, all that stuff, experimenting with drugs, lying, bullying, getting arrested. I mean, delinquency was very broadly defined here. All that stuff went down, right? And here's the thing. I mean, you're not, as one of my favorite adolescent psychologists and researchers said to me, you're not going to find an 8-year-old sitting at home experimenting with drugs, right? That's something that happens during the teen years. I mean, from the point of view of, you know, the brain's neurocircuitry, the teen years are really interesting years because adolescent brains are awash in dopamine, which means they feel things very, very intensely.
Mm-hmm.
It means that they also, and that they experience pleasure very acutely. Their prefrontal cortexes are not done developing, which means that they are not terrific at self-restraint and at all kinds of executive kind of decision-making. They don't plan well. They don't, you know, self-regulate particularly well, but they have sort of an outsized sense of how rewarding a risk is going to be. So you can you know, imagine that during the years when your kid's brain is sort of the way that Steinberg thinks of it, is that they're like cars with very sensitive accelerators but very weak brakes. That you can imagine that during that time, a parent might have more of an interest in being around, right?
Okay, so parents really are the anti-drug, you know, something that we've been hearing for years.
I don't know if it, well, that's funny. I mean, I think that some of it boils down to this. When adolescent kids misbehave, people sort of think that they are misbehaving in the backseat of a car on a weekend. And the peak time for adolescent malfeasance is between 3 and 6 o'clock, and it tends to be in their own home, so or the home of a friend. So simply by being at home, simply by being there, you are functioning as a deterrent. And the interesting thing about adolescent kids is we have this idea that they hate their parents, that they despise adult company, that they find us a drag. But if you actually survey adolescents themselves, they will give their parents exceedingly low marks for not knowing what's going on in their lives. And in a very wistful kind of way, they wish their parents knew more. So in that way, it's kind of win-win all around.
So we were joking earlier about, you know, can you take family leave to spend time with your adolescents? But there are some allowances, aren't there, for parents to take leave if their adolescents are in, what, serious trouble?
If they're in, that's exactly it. So the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act, allows you to take care of someone who's seriously ill.
Now, what
right?
does that mean?
I mean, exactly. So that's the point. So does your kid who is like kind of his grades are slipping and he just wrapped his car around a tree, but he's fine. Is he seriously unwell or is he simply 17 or 16? You know, I mean, you'd have to make the case to your employer that he was in the care of a physician in an ongoing way being treated for something chronic. So if your adolescent is suffering from real, you know, acute depression, if your adolescent is really struggling in a significant way with drugs or alcohol, then, you know, you'll be able to get the kind of documentation you need. But if you simply want to just kind of make sure that they are not going a little bit off the rails or too much off the rails, you know, I don't know. I guess there would be doctors who would be willing to write notes for that. But I don't know how parents are going to make that determination. I think the point is that if adolescence in general requires a little bit more vigilance because adolescent brains are slightly hinky until they're not, you know, then it's something between the Family Medical Leave Act and what we have now, which is zero,
right.
Would be nice.
A recent study by the Journal of Marriage and Family is making a big splash by saying that parents don't necessarily need to spend more time with their kids. My guest, Jennifer Senior, however, is making a case for spending more quality time when it really matters. That's in the adolescent years. Jennifer, you just mentioned the Family Medical Leave Act. Have there been any other efforts to address the care of adolescent children specifically?
It's interesting. Members of Congress in both the House and the Senate have scribbled in extra kind of wording into a bill that says that if, you know, Congress gets around to sort of funding or mandating sick leave, part of what it should be is that it should allow parents to leave for parent-teacher conferences. That is a very small thing. It's really small. But at least it's something. I mean, your kid's teacher notices that your kid's suffering or acting out or doing whatever, you can at least be there. So this led, you know, to a discussion that I had with Lawrence Steinberg about, well, how about just taking the occasional afternoon off to check in on your kid, to be with your kid, to do stuff with them, right? Just to make sure that they're not veering wildly, you know, off course.
I'd love to key into that because your article was in response to this large-scale family study that was released last week, I guess, by the Journal of Marriage and Family. It's made a huge splash because it challenges some very long-held myths about spending time with kids. You know, first of all, it says busts the myth of working mothers don't spend enough time with their children, counters this idea that the more time that you spend with your kids, the better, and that the best parents have lives dominated by their children. So that idea of taking time off still reinforces this idea that if you are a working parent, you are not spending enough time with your kids.
Well, what was interesting is that the only way that study said that spending extra time with your kids made any difference at all was during adolescence. That was the only period, and it was just along a few axes. And it was only, and mothers, it was only in terms of curbing delinquency. It was actually with both parents. Both were needed to curb like a kind of wider variety of problems. But for mothers, it was a very small thing, and it was only during adolescence. I mean, it was still, like I said, not a very big statistical effect, just one that people could read. But that study also, you know, it has since come under fire from Justin Wolfer's writing in the New York Times, saying that he thought the methodology was, you know, terrible. So it's been criticized. The problem is that, of course, this methodology is the gold standard for all American time use studies. So if he's going to throw out that one, he'd have to throw out practically everybody has ever cited. The other thing is that, you know, it had a big enough sample size that it still should have been able to kind of overcome some of his reservations about it. But just so you know, the study has itself come under fire for its, you know, methods. I still think it's pretty good.
Yes, I think a lot of parents do because it's alleviated a lot of guilt.
Right. But if we can go to that for a second, I mean, I don't find the results of this study particularly surprising because ever since women have started working, we've been spending more time with our kids.
Well, that amazes me. It just amazes me. So what were our parents doing?
Well, this is the thing. I can tell you exactly what they were doing. Back in the 60s, women spent much less time with their kids than moms do now. Even working moms who work outside the home, spend more time with their kids than moms did in the mid-60s. And the reason for this is very simple. Moms in the mid-60s were keeping a perfect house. They were buffing their floors to a high shine. They were making sure that there was no more ring around the collar. They were making impeccable and scrumptious meals. But they were putting their infants in playpens, and they were telling their young kids to get on their bikes and play out in the street and to not come back until 6 o'clock when they banged a gong. Now, none of us can cook, and our houses are absolutely filthy, but we all spend a lot of time with our kids. So what we're neglecting by going off to work is not our children, it's our houses. Our houses are the problem. Like, they're what's a mess, but our kids are getting more time than ever. So I never thought that, I mean, so the idea to even be looking at this question is driven by this anxiety sort of that this culture has and this great ambivalence that we still all have about women working. But the fact is, the more women have worked, the more time they've spent with their kids. The two have risen in tandem.
Well, the house can wait then. Jennifer Senior, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Senior is contributing editor for New York Magazine, and she wrote The Case for Taking Parental Leave When Kids Are Teenagers. You'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. She's also author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. The book is now out in paperback. From Mean Girls to Clueless to Fast Times at Ridgemont High, teenagers are great fodder for film. Just take a look at the director John Hughes catalog.
Eat my shorts.
You just bought yourself another Saturday, mister.
Oh, I'm crushed.
What about prom, Blaine?
Oh, Andy, I'm having a bad day. Can we talk later?
No. What about prom?
Come on, why don't we just meet after school?
No! What about prom?
Andy, come on.
Anderson?
Here.
Bueller.
But the roots of the teen movie go back much further than Ferris Bueller. WNYC's Sarah Fischko brings us the story.
It is generally agreed upon and often stated that the first and most emblematic teenage moment on film is in Rebel Without a Cause, 1955. It occurs at the beginning of the film, just as Jim Stark, played by James Dean, is being picked up by his mom and dad from the local jail, where he's been detained for drunkenness. He looks at his bewildered, annoying parents and says,
"You're tearing me apart!"
That's supposed to be the line and the movie that started it all. By that time, after the poverty of the Great Depression, after the sacrifices of the war years, we'd finally reached a period of enough affluence for teens to be in a sort of existential mess filled with questions of identity. They became fixtures on American screens. Before all this, the American teenager was barely an idea. The word teenager itself was only about 10 years old in 55. The first inkling of a need for a transitional period between childhood and adulthood began to dawn on us in the early 20th century.
A group of psychologists and social scientists start discovering this sort of chronological realm in human existence known as adolescence.
Thomas Dougherty's book, Teenagers and Teen Pics, looks at what he calls the juvenilization of movies in the 1950s and the history of teendom.
Mainstream culture talks about it as the younger generation or the problem of the younger generation, usually. And then around the Second World War, you get that phrase that we use, teenager. And that enters the Dictionary of American Slang around 1945. And that's when this creature that has been with us ever since really starts emerging in American culture.
As the idea was absorbed gradually into the culture, so it appeared in the movies. The teens of what you might call the pre-Dean era are completely different specimens in a market that had not yet been defined. Because, after all, in those days, everybody went to the movies, so the movies were made for everybody.
So if you look at, you know, representative classical Hollywood films, you know, like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, Wizard of Oz, they have a pretty wide generational scope in them.
George, Harry, come down to dinner this minute.
You got, you know, grandparents, a sort of older married adults, you got very young kids, you got young people and the boy and the girl and all that, because they configured cinema as being for this big undifferentiated mass.
It's the undifferentiated mass that allowed for the Andy Hardy series to be born in the 1930s.
Look, Dad, can I talk to you man to man?
That's the way I always wanted to be.
Stories of Judge Hardy and his family, with Mickey Rooney as his teen son, struggling to become a grown-up.
Well, man to man, Dad. Can a guy be in love with two girls at once?
In the Andy Hardy films, the purpose is basically to reinforce the wisdom of good old Judge Hardy, Andy's dad. And, you know, every film they have this man-to-man talk, and Judge Hardy gives Andy the advice that will serve him in good stead as he becomes an adult. So these films are very much part of the older model of instruction.
Oh, Dad, you don't have to worry. I'm never going to get married, ever.
That's a momentous decision.
It's a different model of adult, too, of course. You take wise old Judge Hardy, epitome of the head-shaking, all-be-darned, all-knowing dad, and put him up against a more domestic Jim Backus, who played James Dean's father in 1955.
Hello. Hi, Jimbo. You thought I was Mom?
Crawling around on his knees in an apron, you know, not exactly an admirable patriarchal authority figure for Jim Stark in Rebel Without a Cause.
Less than 10 years after Love Finds Andy Hardy, in the post-World War II America of the best years of our lives, the admirable patriarchal authority figure, Dad, has been away in the war.
It's a samurai sword, Rob. Thanks very much, Dad.
He returns to his town and his family only to find that the world has moved on. He barely recognizes his children, who now, in teenhood, look and talk like young adults.
You're just kidding me, Dad. You've been to all these places and you've seen everything.
With no apparent teen characteristics.
I've seen nothing. I should have stayed home and found out what was really going on.
Later in the 40s, you had films like The Bachelor and The Bobby Soxer. Shirley Temple, no less, teenaged, with a crush on grown-up Cary Grant. By that time, teenagers, the word had just gone from the adjective teenaged to the noun, had some of their own lingo and the beginnings of a teen life.
Mellow greetings, yookie dookie.
Dickie.
Ready, poop, let's scoot.
Wheat.
Wheat.
In Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer,
step right up and get yourself a sack.
One central scene is a small town sack race. Contrast that with cars zooming off cliffs in Rebel only 8 years later, and you can get a feel for how fast the culture is moving. A lethal version of the pre-Dean teen turns up in film noir, too, in the late 40s.
I've been thinking.
What about?
Anne Blythe's awful, money-hungry, murderous Vida in Mildred Pierce. She is a teen with no redeeming social values.
What if you married him? Maybe we could have a maid like we used to, and a limousine.
And no Pierce.
And maybe a new house.
She'd rather fool around with Mom's rich, fading playboy husband than friends her own age. That's the hallmark of the pre-Dean teen, really. All of them want to grow up to be adults. Good adults, like Andy Hardy, or bad adults, like Vida.
You don't really think I could be in love with a rotten little tramp like you, do you?
Only a few years later, and we're into The Wild One.
Pop me, Dad. I popped you, Dad.
Brando and his biker friends.
Me, will you, Daddy-o?
Come on. That's it. Tummy. Now give me some skin and ooze it out. Just nice.
Youth has arrived, traveling in packs. They want to be who they are in their generation.
To pick up on this job.
They proclaim their culture, which by now they own completely.
The rebob, Dad. The rebob. He's a square man. Don't you get this at all?
A year later, there was James Dean. Surely Brando had paved the way. Dean even said as much. He famously gave his pal Dennis Hopper an explanation of his aesthetic. He said, "I've got Brando in one hand saying, screw you, and I've got Montgomery Clift in the other hand saying, help me. Somewhere in the middle is James Dean." So where did Brando and Clift come from? Well, they had Mickey Rooney in one hand saying, gee whiz, and Anne Blythe in the other saying, I don't care. In other words, they, along with James Dean, invented something quite new that turned movie teens completely around forever. From the Fishko Files, I'm Sarah Fishko.
Up next, word of mouth waxes nostalgic for that particular anticipation and the good old days of the darkroom and the one-hour photo. We're going to test a new app that turns your smartphone into an old-school disposable camera. That's after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A couple of months ago, we talked to Greg Beck. He's the creator of a counterintuitive photo app called The White Album, which basically turns your smartphone into a disposable camera. So here he is explaining how the app works.
It's really, really simple. So you get it on your phone and you take a roll, essentially, of 24 photos. And when you're done shooting, you just order them and you don't have to think about it again. And they just get sent to your door, these physical photos printed on really premium paper in a nice package.
But I don't get to look at the photographs after I've taken them.
That is the big twist. Yeah. So when you take the photos, we sort of encourage you to just be in the moment a little bit. And so you don't get to reflect on the photos immediately. There's no instant gratification. You can't edit them or post them to a social network or even delete them. You just take them and then move on. And then you get to relive these moments when they're in your hands as printed photos.
Greg said he came up with the idea for his app when he was on a trip to Korea. He was snapping hundreds of photos on his phone, and at some point he realized that the likelihood that he would actually print any of them out was pretty slim. They simply didn't have that individual value that they would if he had a limited number of shots, the way we used to before digital cameras and smartphones. It was on that same trip that he sat down with a Korean family as they went through an old photo album.
And oddly enough, when we're going through some of these old photos, be they a week old or a year old or 10 years old, some of those quirkier ones or blurry ones, just because they're not perfect or professional quality that'll be showing in a gallery somewhere, there's still something really special about that, knowing that you took it, you were there with that person, and it's okay that they blinked.
Greg wanted to see if a smartphone app could recreate that anticipation of picking up your photos at the pharmacy or passing around boxes of old family photos. So our producer, Logan Shannon, downloaded the White Album app. And at the same time, producer Taylor Quimby shot a roll of film on an old-school disposable camera. Well, the prints are in, so the Word of Mouth crew gathered in the studio to see how they came out.
Well, why don't we look at the White Album pictures first? And
okay.
That's those ones.
All right, those are the ones that...
Oh.
In a box. In an album.
Very nice packaging.
The anticipation is over. Enjoy your photos.
Oh, my goodness.
Ooh, yeah, Taylor's
they feel nice. The paper feels kind of...
Oh, cool. It's kind of like a Polaroid.
Oh, there's Virginia.
Oh, no, is it... I have to see that.
That's actually a great picture.
Yeah.
These are nice. They are like Polaroids. They have a thick lower frame.
Yeah, I'm gonna...
I skipped ahead.
What? So you could see yourself?
Yes.
That is so like, right? That's what I used to do. Maureen and I were just talking about that. We'd flip through to see pictures of ourselves.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's a sign of how long it took you to finish out this role.
Yeah,
is that I still have my goatee in that picture. I shaved that off like a month and a half ago.
Wow. How long has it been?
So the first photo was on February 10th, and the last photo I took was March 17th.
Logan, yeah. What took you so long?
Yeah, so part of it was sometimes I would forget that it was there. But then often when I would, oh, right, I need to take a picture using this app, I would open the app and I would feel a little like, oh, this is a special picture. Mm-hmm. This isn't a regular picture that I'm taking. And I'll admit that in some cases with these pictures, I would take a picture with my camera.
Oh, a rehearsal.
Oh, that's cheating. Rehearsal. It is cheating. And I did it.
But that's the there would be other times where probably, you know, you'd be like, oh, I want to take a picture of this, but I want to be able to see it. And I want to take multiple pictures. I want to make sure they're good.
Yeah.
So I'll use my phone like a normal camera.
Yep.
And then now I'll take the one off with my disposable camera app.
Right.
So which is interesting because one matters and one doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, sort of one you just toss off.
Yeah.
And then the other you actually think through.
I have to say, I was expecting them to be more disastrous. I mean, there's definitely some that are better than others, but I was expecting it to feel more like it does when you get a disposable camera back and you're like, oh my, why did I take a picture of that?
No, those were really cool.
Yeah,
nice.
It looks like you thought them through.
Well, I did. I think I was super self-conscious about it in the sense that I really wanted them to be good because I knew that we would all be sitting in here. I really felt like I was back at art school and people were going to be critiquing me, so I needed to be on my game.
See, now this is funny because I had the opposite reaction. So we basically, at the same time that Logan was taking the pictures with the White Album, we ended up getting an actual disposable camera. And that was, for the most part, in my possession. And I was deliberately taking almost bad pictures. I would, like, take pictures at points where nobody was paying attention. You know, I just sort of, like, whipped out the camera and took pictures whenever. So I think we're going to see.
Yeah.
Some more of the classic.
Oh, are there those ones that like where your fingers like obscuring half of the photo?
Actually, Taylor, you just pulled this all out. You get negatives. You don't get negatives.
Oh, actually, no, these aren't negatives. They don't give you negatives anymore. It's a CD.
Oh, they give you the CD.
Also, I had to take this to CBS. They had to mail it to, I think, North Carolina. It took 2 weeks. It was $18. So it was the same price, basically, except I had to go to CBS and then pick them up 2 weeks later.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so to be honest, Finn took some of these pictures.
And Finn is?
Finn
is my 3-year-old son.
It's so funny. The lighting is so harsh with the old school disposable camera.
They're awful. I mean, that's the thing. It's like the reason I think that you just point and click is because you know they're going to be bad pictures.
Oh, my gosh. And they're so grainy.
Yeah.
There's something way more nostalgic about, even though the quality is so much worse with the Taylor's disposable camera that feels more old school. Yeah.
Well, that's because they look bad. They're bad photos. You don't see bad photos anymore.
I know,
but I don't know if it's a fair comparison because he just tossed them off and Logan really thought about them and really composed them.
Yeah, but look at this. Like, you would never see this on an iPhone because an iPhone.
Right, that's a terrible.
You know, this is like a terrible, grainy.
This one is shot inside of the studio, so it's actually dark.
I mean, how often, with your iPhone, like, how often do you actually use a flash?
Never. I avoid
and with
it.
A disposable camera, you have to use the flash every time because if you don't use a flash, it's totally dark.
I can't believe you spent $18 on these.
Oh, well, I'm going to write that off.
Look at the color of the walls in our office. That's so weird. It just is really, it's a greenish cast on everything.
So I guess the question now is it worth it? You know, I mean, is it really worth it either to use the White Album on your iPhone or to still pick up disposable camera, you know, and actually send your film away? Is it worth it these days?
I think the White Album is interesting. And I think, you know, I'm a sucker for packaging, for one thing. The packaging is beautiful. The presentation is beautiful. And the mood is different. And I think it is because we have a reference for the disposable camera. As you were saying, you know, it's just that kind of thing you pick up and shoot. But these are more considered more like an old school, what is it, 110 camera or, you know?
I don't know. It's hard. The thing for me is that you can't go back. So it's like, you know, you use this on your phone, you have the White Album, it's cool. But like you said, Logan, you were also just using the normal camera function on your phone to take pictures at the same time. So it's like we like to pretend that we can go back to a time when things were simpler and photos were physical. But at the same time, like, you can't actually go back in time.
And I think if you go back truly nostalgic to this old school, you know, disposable camera, looking at the quality of these, it doesn't bring me back in a good way. I wouldn't want to go back to these. It reminded me of like, oh, yeah, that was so annoying when you used to get a disposable camera or a camera when you were in high school and take photos and like only a third of them were good.
Right. It was never worth it. And I think from my perspective, you know, having recently cleaned out my mother's and father's house and getting these old photographs that have this sense of preciousness. You know, they contain something that's so precious. And it is because, sort of like you were saying, Taylor, you're not, you know, we can't go back in time and capture that sense of preciousness. And, you know, why pretend? But I actually wondered if looking at these piles of photos, like we have the White Album photos all nicely stacked and fanned. We've just thrown all of the disposable photos like in the middle of the table, like a pile of rot or something like that, because they don't, there's something about meaning.
We should put these all in a time capsule. And look at them again.
And I'll be like, nope, they're still,
nope, still a lousy photo.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including a link to subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please write a review or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.